You can't say that.
Traitor. Traitor.
She's still sleepy.
Are you not well, honorable member?
When are you paying the money?
Hey, hey.
Hong.
You are not allowed to be emotional.
Take your seat.
Draw the lela pili.
Nkanja.
That's unparliamentary.
Hey. Good day and welcome to our second installment of the Sunday Times Weekly. Thank you so much for joining us this time around. Last week we spoke very lengthily about state capture, and we're hoping that we'd start off with the same this week. This week I'm joined with my colleagues Zingisa Mvumvu and Zimasa Matiwane, who both sit on the Sunday Times politics desk, and you would have seen their bylines in the newspaper. They produce some brilliant stories. So let's just get some of their views on this past weekend's paper. Zingisa, let's look at our headline. The CIA alerted SA to Gupta nuclear danger in 2009. This was almost 10 years ago. So officials in our state knew that there was danger coming, but we've waited for this whole process to go on, and only now we're starting to unpack what happened. Man, we could have sorted this out well before. Why do you think that everyone was quiet? Do you think they were afraid?
Well, yeah, no, I think that's a good question. I mean, it's almost 10 years, 2009. By next year, it will be 10 years. And I think that's the burning question about why now. But I mean, you would understand that the person who's alleged to have been at the center of this, as per the story, the former spy bosses, Moshek, Jeff Maqetuka, and the third guy?
It's Mzuvukile Matajeka.
Yeah, so I mean, they were there, they were working for the state, and they do say that they did, after getting the alert, they did their own investigation and informed the president. The president just told them that he cannot do anything because these Guptas are helping his daughter and his son.
Let's look at some of the details in the story. So the U.S. intelligence flagged the Guptas' dubious activity as far back as 2009, resulting in intelligence agencies that conducted the family said that the family was a threat to national security. And then they say that in 2010, it was the Guptas who started sort of flexing their political muscle with their links to the president. So we know this goes back quite far. But my argument then is, maybe Zamasa, you want to come in here, if we've got people like Njenje and Sheikh and Matajuka who knew about this back then, should they have alerted other people besides the president if they knew the president was involved? Should they not have gone to someone else? Maybe the public protector or another authority?
We have many capable institutions in South Africa that would have taken initiative if the president was not willing to do anything. So partly, as much as they did flag this issue to the president, partly I blame them for keeping quiet and not, you know, alerting the public protector, as you've mentioned, and only coming out now, you know, years later after the damage has been done.
Sigis, I mean, if you were one of these people, what would you have done? Knowing that your job's on the line here.
Yeah. No, look, I mean, in as far as alerting other people, you would understand that these people were working in the intelligence of the country, the highest, at that particular sector. So you would know that there are rules there. Issues of intelligence, that's why even in parliament, they're not publicized. It's a private thing. Not everything in the spy world is for everyone.
Can I interject?
Yes.
Can I interject? Because as a public servant, these people are paid with our tax money. Mm. As a public servant, firstly, you are loyal to the Constitution. You are loyal to the public in South Africa, and patriotism should drive the work that you do. So hiding behind the spy.
No, but there are rules of engagement. That's certain issues, especially issues of national security. I'm sure at that particular stage, those are the issues that you can only discuss.
Yeah.
Well, but I'm sure we've got issues of the ombuds. I'm sure there's something like often ombuds men in terms of the intelligence.
There's an oversight committee for parliament.
Of course. I mean, they could have gone there, but again, as we say, these guys, they had their families to feed, and eventually, indeed, they did get fired for their taking interest in the Guptas. So perhaps they could have been fired for something better by alerting someone who would have made
agree.
A move on the Guptas. So yeah, it's quite a messy one.
Let's talk about another story on page 4 of the Sunday Times this past weekend. Cost to spruce up ministers' luxury homes rattles MPs. If you look at this, so the state pays $1.3 billion is the estimated market value for 140 houses occupied by ministers in Cape Town and Pretoria. $7.3 million, the amount spent on municipal services, rates and taxes for 73 houses in Pretoria, and $20.8 million cost of municipal services, rates and taxes for 67 houses in Cape Town. This is just in 1 year. Guys, if you're looking at this type of money, how many houses could this have built? We pay our ministers exorbitant salaries already. Salaries that some of us only dream of, especially as journalists. Should we be giving them this comfortable life as well?
Well, my is simple. This is insane. South Africa is so much of a welfare country that we are giving welfare services even to people who are earning ridiculous, highly salaries. These guys, ministers, don't earn anything less than R1 million per annum. I mean, where do these guys ever spend their money? We fly them. We drive them around. We give them Mercedes Benz. I mean, top
we give
of the
them
German cars.
Nice houses in Cape Town and Pretoria.
Expensive, bright areas. You know, so surely, brother, we need to reconsider the perks that come with being ministers. And this has got far-reaching implications. I mean, perhaps these are some of the things that fuel things that such as political violence, because people are vying for these things. You know, once you get into government, your salary, you barely spend it. You literally save it for your entire career, because everything is paid for. You've got a house in Cape Town, you've got a house in Pretoria, all expenses paid for. You can fly in between any day and every day. It's for free, but surely, then why do we pay these people? I think certain perks, there should be, some perks should remain to make their jobs easier, you know. But some of the things really are really luxurious things that they can do themselves,
I guess,
with the money.
Like, I guess for us
as journalists. A dining room table for 84,000 in a country with such high levels of poverty and high levels of unemployment is just simply immoral, especially from someone who claims to be a public representative. They are not serving us. They are not representing us in 84,000 dining room tables when we can't even afford a loaf of bread.
So I can sort of understand money being put towards sort of the president and the deputy president, where issues around security come into effect. Obviously, the houses that they're going to be staying in, you need to have your top security, you need to have your top transportation, you need to keep these guys safe. But for every old minister, a house for each of them. And then if you look at some of the stats here as well, let's just say, Zimasa, you're traveling out on the story, you expect the company to sort of sort out your flights and your accommodation. As public servants, do you think that we should be treating them like members of the public? Maybe putting them in a 3 or 4 star hotel with their security guards. Obviously, some rooms for them as well. But should we be spending billions?
I think as long as they are safe and they are comfortable, that's what matters. It shouldn't be about luxury. It should be about safety and comfort.
Reasonable
comfort. And also, you know, issues of proximity to perhaps where they are going to maybe do some oversight work, maybe. But it I don't know. You know, there's blue lights with 12 cars behind and 12 cars in front. I don't understand. I don't understand.
Yeah, no, but seriously, I mean, there has to be something. And it's very sad that government has been promising about cutting this and cutting that, cutting this. Instead, now we hear they're going for reducing the public servants' wage bill. I think this is the best that they should start right at the top, because that is where the problem starts. They should start looking at the perks of the president himself, go down to ministers and check where can we, tighten the belt and reduce some of the benefits before you even go down. I'm sure right there alone we can save more than R500 million if we were to relook at those things.
So we humbly tuma the president.
Yeah, since he's requested that we must tuma him, we are tuming him to start looking at the perks and reduce that, starting with his and all his ministers. I mean, and surely, I mean, we are hopeful that the cabinet slashing in terms of the positions that are there that he promised. We hope that it will come into effect next year.
So he has promised that he's going to slash his cabinet. So should he then also slash the amount of money spent on his ministers as well?
Yeah,
oh, definitely.
It's
we should. These people ought to spend
some of their salary.
Really, bro, these people barely spend their salaries. They need to start spending now if we were to get somewhere.
Some good points.
And really, that will be leading with morality, as Zuma was saying. That will be moral in a country where poverty is so rife, where people would see that these people are so concerned about the state of being. I mean, given our economy that is sluggish, at least they should give, they should lead by example by showing that they have an interest.
We just entered a technical recession,
So
we can't have that.
We can't have those things. We need to have people leading by example. If we see them leading by example, it will encourage everyone even to look after their finances and spend responsibly and better.
Let's talk about one more thing before we leave. Last week, interestingly, in Nelson Mandela Bay, Athol Trollip was given the boot. Let's look at some of the stats. I mean, Athol Trollip represents the biggest represented party in the Western Cape. You've got the DA now, who's got the not the majority, but about 46%, I believe it is, of the votes of Nelson Mandela Bay. They were kicked out by the ANC, who have slightly less, on sort of the behest of the EFF, who have 6% of the votes. And they've put in a mayor with whose party, the UDM, only got 2% of the public support in Nelson Mandela Bay. It's outrageous. Can coalitions work going into next year if this is the sort of dynamic that we're working with already?
Look, my guy, for me, I mean, if what we've seen so far since 2016 up to now is anything to go by, I think these coalitions are quite a disaster, especially for service delivery and the people, the voters. I mean, in Nelson Mandela Bay, where Athol Trollip was booted out last week, how many times have there been a vote of no confidence? When does this council actually get to work and deliver services to the people that voted for them? Very less. Much time is spent on personal politics. We must put this one out. And I can tell you now, even the new mayor, Mongame Boban, is not going to have an easy one. I mean, I'm sure very soon there will be a vote of no confidence against him. So it raises the question, where do these guys really get to do the work that they were employed for, that they were voted for by the people to deliver the services? People are suffering. And I think, I mean, the ANC said this, but, well, it's very strange coming from them, that perhaps fresh elections are a better solution so that people decide. But perhaps this is a lesson for people in the future to be more decisive about who they want to govern them. I think if you are governed by any other party, it doesn't matter which party it is, even if they are doing bad, they wouldn't be as bad as coalitions are, because at least there will be coherence in terms of who is governing, and they would get to the business of the day without having to focus on those petty politics.
Simo, so let me ask you quickly. Let's take the example of Nelson Mandela Bay and let's sort of cast that into a national framework. All right, you've got 2019 coming up. Let's say we're dealing with the same sort of dynamics next year, hypothetically, where the DA and the ANC get very similar sort of support, and the EFF and other smaller parties are able to bridge that gap and then side with either or. Judging by Nelson Mandela Bay, can these parties work together on a national scale if there was a coalition next year?
Initially, I was happy with coalitions because I thought at least these people will play watchdog against each other for the benefit of the community. But it's proven to be the opposite. And I think it's a good thing that it happened within the local government sector. At least now we know that it's a disaster. And I don't think South Africans want it provincially or even nationally, that kind of shared power. I would hope for a majority win, whatever political party. The thing is with South African political parties is they have very different ideological, stances.
Perspectives, yeah.
So it's close to impossible to expect the ANC, for example, to work together with the DA. Even for South Africans, which they all claim to want to serve. So I'm comfortable with a majority win. I'm comfortable with a strong opposition, but I don't want shared power.
And also maybe just to add on Zimasa's ideological perspectives thing. I mean, with the DA and EFF, I am one who's always said that it will never work out. These are extreme, a bipolar, you know, on bipolar perspectives as far as their ideologies are concerned. We know that the EFF is extreme left, DA is center to right. Mm. So it was never going to work out. In fact, their coalition, we know for a fact, it was formed on the basis of EFF's hate of the president at the time, which was President Jacob Zuma, who is no longer the president of the country. Therefore, that common enemy that they had is no longer in the picture. So it was expected for the EFF to sort of change in terms of its relation with the DA. It was never going to last. And that is what happens when you conduct politics on convenience purposes, because it was never about the people. It was never about ideology.
Do you guys think EFF and ANC coalitions could work?
That's an interesting question. I think that the ANC and the EFF are more sort of ideologically and policy aligned.
Yeah.
I think that sort of, but at the same time, where does that then leave your more radical side of the EFF? The question would be, is the EFF too radical for the ANC?
Yeah.
But at the same time, with their policies and their sort of centered together, they could actually work. Whereas the EFF could keep, would may actually be a good watchdog over the ANC at the same time. They've done it so well.
Yeah.
but then that would leave, how do we then also take care of other people in our society? You know, the DA also has a target market.
Yeah,
let's be honest. And and people who share the same views as that center right. So then how does the ANC and the EFF, a coalition there, then take care of that bunch of people? Do we have a gap in our policy afterwards then, and a gap in our ideology? That's what we'll have to ask ourselves. But luckily, elections are just only just a year away. I guess we'll find out next year.
Very much.
And we're all going to be extremely busy until then.
Yeah.
There's going to be some sleepless nights. But thank you so much, comrades, for joining me today. Thank you so much for listening, listeners. And we'll catch up next week.